This is Jerry Grubbs, September 11th, 2004, Bereavement Dreaming.
I'm going to be, of course, tonight, I'm going to be focusing on bereavement dreaming, the dreams that we have following the death of a loved one, and especially a sudden death of a loved one, which really puts us into a very suffering state. I'm going to be focusing on the healing capacity of the archetypes, how the archetypes lift and can hold and contain us when we're going through this very difficult period. I'm going to talk about the state of liminality, the void state that one goes into immediately after the sudden loss of a loved one, and also characteristics of visitation dreams, and which are quite common in bereavement dreams, and dreams that I refer to as transliminal dreams, which are very different than everyday dreams that we have. And these transliminal dreams happen during the grief period. And then I'm also going to attempt to address why our dreams are different during in the grief period. Why are they... I wouldn't say they're profoundly different, but they are definitely different. And I'll attempt to address why it is that way. And then the highlight of the evening is going to be a slide presentation as I discuss the images and themes of bereavement dreams, especially from that archetypal level, ancient funerary rites and death that is pretty common in bereavement dreams. So I'll be showing the slides as I present that, so you'll have some visual with it. Okay, a quote from Jung in Collected Works 8, The Soul and Death. When death confronts us, life always seems like a downward flow or like a clock that has been wound up and whose eventual running down is taken for granted. We are never more convinced of this running down than when a human life comes to its end before our eyes, and the question of the meaning and worth of life never becomes more urgent or more agonizing than when we see the final breath leave a body which a moment before was living. Now, the loss of a loved one can affect all aspects of our life and certainly can even change its course and direction. And it's even known to put us into an existential crisis where we wonder about the meaning of life, and is there life after death, and is there really a God because of this horrible tragedy that's happened to me. And during that period, the archetypal images are very, very strong. They come in very powerfully during that time. So I've observed, just from my own experience and from my research as well, how the soul prepares us. Not only does the soul help us afterwards by lifting us and holding us, but prepares us beforehand with precognitive dreams that begin to prepare us for this eventual tragedy that's going to come into our lives. And this can come as many as a couple of years before the death occurs. Now I'm going to start with my story. 20 years ago, I lost my son, my 16-year-old son, Michael, very suddenly. And the way he died, he was on his way to a party, and there was a fight that broke out, and he tried to leave the fight and walked away from it. And as he was walking away, one of the boys chased after him and hit him full force on the head, which knocked him onto the cement walk. He hit his head flat on the cement walk, which caused brain damage. And then a few days later, he was brain dead. Actually, he was brain dead shortly after. We had him on life support for 3 days, and his brain waves never came back, so we had to turn it off. In my book, I explain or describe what it was like for me right after his death. My outer life returned to normal after his funeral, but my internal world remained disconnected for months afterward. I had been recording my dreams for years before Michael's death, so I was well aware that they had become profoundly different during the months following his death. Not only did they express my pain, they also showed me a new dimension of reality, that other place in which my son now existed. It was that world that communicated the true reality of my state of being at the time. Visions of Michael living in another place and time, grossly vivid aspects of the death and transformation of matter, and illuminations that could be called transcendent. So the aura of death followed me everywhere. And it began not when Michael died, but actually began 18 months before his death, when I had a precognitive dream that told me that it was going to happen and there was nothing I could do about it. I want to read that dream to you. I would describe it, but I think to read it, explain or all the details are expressed by reading it. So I'm going to do that. This is the dream I had, the precognitive dream, 18 months before he died. I am making arrangements to buy something related to tennis and do it in a forceful way. Then one night, Ed, Cora, Michael, and I are sleeping in an apartment high up in a tall building. I hear dogs howling below in the dark night. Several men climb a ladder and enter our apartment through a window. I hear Michael run out of his room to see who it is. I know they are going to hurt us and am afraid for my son. One of the men strikes Michael on the back of the head with a tennis racket and kills him. Another comes through my window and hurts me as well, but not fatally. I scream at the intruder and cry so hard I can't get the words out. In the morning, a group of young boys clean up the mess. I cry hard and ask if something can be done to change this, but nothing I say works. Suddenly, Ed, Cora, and I are at a church attending Michael's funeral. Boys his age are reading in ritual fashion. I cry very hard and ask a male presence if it really has to happen. Is he really dead? Yes, he's dead, he says. In anguish, I plead for a better outcome. Does it have to happen? Is it really the end? And he tells me again and again, yes. So then after the dream, I woke up. It was a very vivid dream, and it was a shaking of a primitive rattle that woke me up. And I immediately wrote the dream down, and still feeling the presence of the dream, I drifted back off to sleep. And as I drifted off to sleep, I could feel the body of a large snake wrapped around my neck. And it was just very intriguing because it didn't scare me. And it felt, in a way, very soothing and very healing or comforting to have this snake around my neck. So that was the dream. When I had that dream, that was quite a while ago. I was working with my dreams a little bit, but not a whole lot. And the first thought that came to my mind was that, I'm going to lose my son. He's not going to be my baby anymore. He's growing into adulthood. And that's what death dreams and death, or death and dreams usually communicate, is that it's a death of an aspect of ourselves, or a death of a relationship, or some part of our lives. It isn't usually the death of a person, although since then I've found otherwise. So that's why I took the dream as meaning that, yeah, I'm going to lose my baby. He's growing up to be a young he's a man. And the dream even had a lot of kind of transitional archetypes in it. So that fooled me as well. Although, you know, reading the dream now, you can see I was in a bit of denial because it seemed to be so clear that this was going to happen and there was nothing I could do about it. So the prophecy in the dream had a definite ominous quality to it. And as I tried futilely to change what was already put into motion, and it appears to be that the dream was sent to prepare me for what was eventually going to come. It seemed to be saying that although I would suffer a catastrophic loss of my son, I would be cared for and healed by the archetypes of the soul. The healing revealed itself in the form of a snake, often assumed by the Greek god Asclepius. And that's the feeling of being supported and healed. It's like I needed to know that I would be supported and I would be held during that real difficult time in my life. And the snake also seemed to add a sacred dimension to the catastrophe that was to come. And it seemed to be important for me to know about that, or to know that that was there as well. So I have found that dreams do prepare us for an upcoming tragedy in our lives. Actually, there are four stories in my book. I'm one of them. And all four of us had precognitive dreams before the death of our loved one. So when death strikes so deeply and personally, it becomes what Jungians refer to as an archetypal experience. So what does that mean, an archetypal experience? I quote in my book on page 8, an archetypal experience is one that is shared in a spiritual sense by all members of the human race. Archetypes are soul material, spiritual energy that arises from the depths of your being. They are in many ways connected to realms of existence that are not of this earth. Jung refers to archetypes as the imago Dei, or the God-likeness in man. He quotes, "They are meant to attract, to convince, to fascinate, and to overpower. They are created out of the primal stuff of revelation and reflect the ever-unique experience of divinity." Another example of an archetypal dream, besides my own, was by a woman whose story is in my book, whose son committed suicide. She had this dream 2 years before he died, while she was on retreat. And when we're on retreat, these archetypal dreams usually are quite strong. We have our big dreams oftentimes when we're introverting. This is her dream. "Just before waking, I saw a dreamlike replica of a wonderful hammered round bronze platter," she said. "It was accompanied by the words, 'It is huge and strong enough to hold anything.' I immediately knew that the image and message would give me courage to bear the anxiety of not knowing. It seemed like a gift I had been given to remind me of the inner strength that was there for me always. The round strength of it, the centeredness. It was a shield in appearance, and although that was not its first meaning, it became that for me. It was a place I could go inside that would not let me down." It didn't take Sarah long to realize that this round bronze platter was an image of the self, or as she said, the God in everyone. She had been reading a lot of Jung and did a lot of work with her dreams and did a lot of spontaneous creative artwork. So she was very familiar with these profound images that come to attract and fascinate us. And as it turned out, Sarah's son died 2 years later, and she turned to that image, that round bronze platter, again and again to give her the strength or remind her that she had the strength to overcome the tragedy that she had in her life. And it was interesting the way that dream showed itself later on in her bereavement dreams. There was one dream that she had where she actually was walking across a very narrow bridge, and it was pretty very high up, and there was raging water below. The left side of the bridge didn't have any railing on it, and the right side had a railing, a bronze railing that she could hold onto and walk as she went across this bridge. And she knew again that took her back to that dream that she had 2.5 years earlier about the bronze platter. Sarah said that the bronze platter helps me to recognize an inner strength that is available if I remember it is there. Now, Stanislav Grof, I think most of us are familiar with Stanislav Grof. He's the founder of the transpersonal psychology movement and researched non-ordinary states of consciousness for 30 long years using psychedelic drugs. I think primarily it was LSD. But his primary purpose in doing that was to define the various different levels of the psyche. And he found that there were 4 levels of the psyche. And they relate very closely to Jung's theories, which is very interesting. The first level is the psychically oriented sensory barrier, which would be the persona, you know, the mask we wear, our relationship to the outer world. The next level is the individual unconscious with its life experiences, traumatic memories, and unresolved conflicts. That would be the personal unconscious, according to Jung. And then there's the perinatal and spiritual realms, or spiritual realm, and then the transpersonal realm that transcends the limitations of time and space. And these last two would be related, this would be the collective unconscious, that not only is within ourselves, but it also transcends up and beyond into the universe. Now, in this last dimension, that transcends the limitations of time and space, the extension of consciousness appears to go beyond earthly existence in space and time and contain images of deceased spirits, archetypes, religious entities, demons, and mythological forms. Grof claims it is critically important to take this realm into consideration when seriously exploring experiences of psychedelic states, shamanism, religion, mysticism, rites of passage, mythology, parapsychology, and schizophrenia. And I'd like to add, too, the state of bereavement, because that, too, puts you're very much in that state of transcendence. So when you're in a transpersonal dimension of the psyche, you transcend the usual limitations of consciousness. You go beyond linear time or ordinary spatial boundaries and experience domains that are not considered part of your everyday life. In this state, you encounter an other world reality that becomes a condition of the liminal state of grief. Now, what I'm saying, and when you're in bereavement, especially during the first month or two, it's like the rug has been pulled right out from under you, and you're floating in the void. You're just hanging there. You're not in the place you were at one time, and you haven't arrived at a new place yet. You're hanging in the void, and this is referred to as the state of liminality. This was a term coined by Arnold van Gennep, anthropologist who studied transition rites with ancient cultures. And he saw that these ancient transitions would transcend from one state of being to another. And that's what happens when you lose a loved one. You're not the mother of a son or a daughter anymore, this particular child. You're not a spouse any longer, or you may be very alone in your life if you've lost your lover. And you haven't really landed in a new place yet. You know, this is the first few months after the loss. So when you're in the state of liminality, you can have some very profound dreams that connect you, and I'll go into it a little bit more detail in a little bit, but it connects you with this, with the deceased spirit and this other dimension of reality, because you're not grounded. Here's an example of the kind of dream that one would have while in this state. This is a dream had by a brother who lost his brother, and he had this dream 2 months after his death. And it seems to address the alchemy of the soul's crossing to from what seems to be the third to the fourth dimension of reality. This is the dream. I had been hanging out with Andrew in some way, but now it was time for him to go. I joined him as he headed up to the third floor where he would pass over. It occurred to me, why should I say goodbye here? I asked him if I could walk with him, and he said, no problem. I didn't intend to watch him pass over. I was just seeing him to the door. He had a sextant-like tool which he looked through to align things. It was metal coated in black. I saw two glasses of liquid, which he told me was what was needed to make this process work. I think one was distilled water and the other was like a chemical from a photographer's darkroom. I let him know how unsettled I was that this process was so tenuous. What if he ran out of these liquids? Oh, well, that'd be it, seemed to be his response. I asked what I could do. He said, get more of those liquids and tell Mom that she was right about that music. That this one particular CD was as close as earthly music could come to mimic. At that moment, he left in the iridescent mist. I averted my eyes to give him privacy, not curious at all. So through the use of the sextant-like tool and two liquids, he demonstrates the precision-like and tenuous nature of crossing what appears to be from the third to the fourth or transcendent dimension. It's complicated and can provide only a photographer's view of life after death. And these dreams even seem to know what we're feeling and the grief we're suffering in the way that, like about the music he shared about tell mother about the music. She had been playing music and she was deep in grief, and he was able to hear that, and so he was able to communicate through his brother that he was there with his mother while she was playing this music. And also he was communicating to her what it's like over there in this other dimension, what it's like after death, and that he was in some way still very connected with her, and he heard what she was playing and communicating to him. Now, there are specific characteristics of dream visitations, and they're presented by Joel Martin in his book, Love Beyond Life. The encounter is very meaningful to the dreamer. The deceased appear as they did in life, but healthier and happier and younger. The dream itself is less disorganized and disjointed than what a regular dream would be. And there's a clear message in the interaction and visitation. There's a clear message in the interaction, and the visitation seems to serve a specific purpose. And the visitation dreams often leave the dreamer with a strong sense of well-being and peace after they've had these the visitation dreams. Now, Jung had a dream following death of his wife, Emma. And he said in a friend following her death, he was very, very deep in grief. He says, "The stillness and the audible silence about me, the empty air and the infinite distance are hard to bear." To another friend, he said, "The loss of my wife has taken it out of me. And at my age, it is hard to recover." And then shortly after this, he saw Emma in a dream that appeared like a vision to him. And he describes this dream in his book, Memories, Dreams, and Reflections. He says, "She stood at some distance from me, looking at me squarely. She was in her prime, perhaps about 30 years old, and wearing the dress which had been made for her many years before my cousin, the medium. It was perhaps the most beautiful thing she had ever worn. Her expression was neither joyful nor sad, but rather objectively wise and understanding, without the slightest emotional reaction, as though she were beyond the mist of affects. I knew that it was not she, but a portrait she had commissioned for me. It contained the beginning of our relationship, the events of 53 years of marriage, and the end of her life also. Face to face with such wholeness, one remains speechless, for it can scarcely be comprehended." And that's a classic dream of a dream visitation, where the deceased comes through the dream and visits. And this came possibly to relieve Jung of the very intense grief he was going through. And actually, the dream visitations can do that very strongly. So why and how do such dreams occur? The Tibetan Buddhists believe that the bereaved slip into a kind of death bardo, or gap between two realities, which is the counterpart of the state of liminality in rituals and life transitions, not being here or there. And it's a juncture when dramatic change can happen in one's life. And they believe that one is in the condition of life after death while sleeping, so that when you go to sleep, your subtle body wanders in that other dimension of reality, and then the deceased or their loved one that has died is also in this dimension, and so they come together during this period, and have their last moments together before the soul eventually goes on to the final destination or resting place. So you can imagine the condition of the bereaved. In a death bardo, with the subtle body reaching out toward their lost loved one at night, at the same time when the deceased spirit is nearby. How powerful that can really be. And it's no wonder that visitations are known to be so prevalent. In a 1990 study on what constitutes normal bereavement following the loss of a loved one, we find that 42% encountered loved ones in dreams, while 71% felt their presence nearby. Now, Eastern religions believe that the bardo of death for the bereaved and coincides with the transitional period of the deceased, and that they both terminate when the deceased spirit is incorporated into the world of the dead. How long this lasts depends on the closeness of the relationship and the complexity at the time of death. Sometimes it could be during a short period for a few months, and then I've actually seen it go on for a year, sometimes even two, if the loss is very complicated or if it's a suicidal death. Now, the dreams had while in this state I refer to as transliminal dreams because they have this transcendent quality to them they tend to occur while the bereaved are in this state of liminality. And so their characteristics, there's very specific characteristics about these dreams. The symbols, archetypes, and the spirit of the deceased are more objective than subjective in nature. Now, in subjective dreams, Jung refers to them as a theater in which the dreamer is himself the scene, the player, the prompter, the producer, the author, the public, and the critic. And most dreams are subjective. I think when we work with our dreams, we're even encouraged to look at them from a subjective point of view. And then there are periods in our life when they're more objective. They have a more transcendent quality to them. Objective dreams come from one's outer life situation or from collective and universal contents. And during transitions, it addresses a collective universal reality to us. They have a specifically sacred spiritual quality to them. They address basic existential questions concerning death, loss, and transformation. And they're often referred to as big dreams. They're dreams that we remember for most of our lives. Now, an example of a dream I had, it was after Michael's death, I had this dream when I was trying to decide to study at the Jung Institute in Zurich. And it goes from the subjective to an objective reality within the same dream. In this dream, I talk my husband into going to therapy and go to meet him at a large building that is supposed to be the Jung Institute. It's an old building with many levels to it. I enter a large room and see various couples meeting in the open with their analyst. I'm late and feeling a bit frantic that I can't find my husband and our analyst. As I search for them, I find myself entering a kind of sanctuary place that's circular with a central spiral staircase going down. I take the stairs, and as I head downward, I see a golden orange circular image on the floor below me. It radiates light, and in the center of it is a wrapped mummy lying on a bier. The bier and coffin seem to be coming up out of the circular rings. I'm mesmerized by what I see and can't take my eyes off of it. So the first part of the dream is pretty much subjective. It has to do with my own personal growth and my relationship and this new change that was coming into my life. And then suddenly I'm drawn to like another area, another dimension. And then I go down and encounter the actually rings of the soul image. It's a mandala that I see. And thing about this dream, it had a definite, it seemed to have a prophetic quality, which a lot of these dreams do have, with the wrapped mummy coming up out of the rings. Because it was when I went to the Jung Institute that I knew I had to analyze the dreams and write about the dreams in a report about the dreams I had following the death of my son, which turned out to be the book that I just published. So now another characteristic of transliminal dreams: when the deceased is in the dreamer feels as if he or she is truly with the deceased and that there is a purpose to their meeting. This is the classic visitation dreams that I talked about a little earlier. Here's an example of one of these visitation dreams had by a woman who lost her husband who died suddenly on a business trip. She says, all of my senses were there on another plane with him. She was in her dream, and suddenly he appeared. That was just as real or more than this one. He had come back from death, but it was no big deal. Nobody mentioned it. We had a wonderfully fun quickie, a nooner. I could feel, taste, and smell him. Waking up was not a downer or depressing at all. I was floating on air for several days. It was like I was just traveling back and forth between time, dimensional, or different planes of existence. So that's a classic dream visitation. Another characteristic of transliminal dreams, the archetypes and symbols represented in the dreams are closely associated with funerary rites and ancient religious and spiritual traditions. The common themes are the death tunnel and bridal chamber. Oftentimes, the bereaved will dream of Osiris, the Egyptian god of resurrection. There's also death weddings, and I'm going to go into these dreams more when I have the slideshow, and I'll describe the various different symbols and images that come up then. Oftentimes, when the dreamer has one of these dreams, they have a real difficult time associating with them. It seems as if this, like for instance, Osiris, the Egyptian god of resurrection, they have nothing to relate to it, so it's like it comes from this other dimension of reality. It comes from that archetypal level. Here's an example of one of those dreams. Deep in grief over the sudden death of her adult son, a mother dreams, I am running with a group of people who are all wearing white. Suddenly I stop because I see a coffin that I know I must prepare. The group is waiting for me to proceed with them, but I must prepare this coffin. It is wood in the shape of my son's coffin. There are sections inside of it, dividing it into quarters, the top being smaller like a cross. I place a white flower at the four ends of the cross. Now, transliminal dreams, they have a transcendent quality to them. There may be a numinous or spiritual aura to the image. The bereaved may have out-of-body experiences in the dream or intimate encounters with images of death. Now here's an example of a dream had by a mother who lost her 12-year-old son in a dirt biking accident. She dreams, we're lying together on the floor on the front porch. It's dark, but Rory's face is very bright and lit up. His head is in my lap. His face is shining. I'm thinking, look at the moonlight on his face. But there was no moonlight coming through the window. It was radiated through his face. So the apparent purpose of transliminal dreams appears to be compensatory. It provides us with soul support when we're really feeling alone and feeling very frightened and very scared. It gives us that support when we're having a difficult time facing the stark reality of death. Or if we're not facing the stark reality of death, it can come to us very vividly and very strongly, and death images to encourage us to face what it is that we're really not looking at. So you might have one or two of these dreams, or they can last for maybe even several months. You can have a whole series of these dreams. There was one woman deep in grief whose son committed suicide, was in this transliminal state for a good 9 months. But normally they tend not to remain very long. Normally they remain about 1 to 2 months. I have some slides to show, and we're going to focus on the archetypal images and themes in bereavement dreams. Do we want to take a break now? And then come back like in 10 minutes or so, and then I'll do that? Okay. To do what?
Could you describe the workshop a little bit?
In the workshop, you really have a lot of time for personal sharing. We're going to focus on the phases of bereavement dreams, and I've included some extra phases too that are very important to look at that. Really address this archetypal level and reunion and renewal. There's a lot of time for sharing, and that ends up to be a big major time that we spend on Saturday. So that's what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. So if you want to come tomorrow, sign up now. Okay, following are archetypal images and themes that are seen often in bereavement dreams. When we face death, either our own or another's, the archetypes of death come upon us whether we know about them or not. Following are the major images that I have come across in bereavement dreams. States that the tunnel is often described as a cave, a well, a trough, an enclosure, a tunnel, a funnel, a vacuum, a void, a sewer, a valley, a cylinder. Von Franz claims that the death tunnel anticipates the course of death. It's known more as an image in near-death experiences. A dream I had 2 weeks after Michael's death. I find myself sitting in a cave listening to life forms who appear as shadow images talking about something very important. It is as though I have been invited to hear something, a plan of sorts, that is communicated as buzzing rather than words. Then it is time for me to leave, and I walk back through a dark tunnel to where my body is sleeping. I don't want to return, but I know I must. As I walk out of the tunnel, I sadly turn and see a bright light with shadows of my fellow beings standing in front of it. They are watching me as if escorting me back with their thoughts. It looked very much like that image, actually. Chambers were built by the Egyptians in their tombs. They're considered the passageway that connects the physical with the spiritual or transcendent world. The passageway drops into a chamber below the earth, referred to as the bridal chamber, a womb in the earth for the dead to await their rebirth. A woman who lost her 15-year-old daughter had this dream shortly after. I'm walking down a dark alley with Michelle, who suddenly falls down a rectangular-shaped hole. To rescue her, I must climb down to where she is. The climb down is slow and scary, but I manage to do it. When I get to the bottom, I find Michelle. There is straw in her hair. The bottom of the pit is covered with straw. I thought it would be dark down here, but there is golden light. Dismembered Osiris from ancient Egypt may also appear early in the dreams of the bereaved, and especially during moments of deep emotional pain. In the Egyptian Book of the Dead, it is said that every person becomes Osiris, the god of resurrection, at the moment of death. If you're not familiar with the god with the myth of Osiris, he was killed by his brother Seth, who was very jealous, cut up his body, and dispersed the parts of his body over the earth. And Osiris's wife, sister wife, Isis, sought all the various parts and put them back together and was able to do that, except for the genitals. So we see this often, this image of body parts in dreams had by the bereaved. Here's a dream that I had after Michael's death. Michael's funeral is in the desert. His body is in a chest, and it is in pieces. I am kneeling beside the box, trying to rearrange the parts so they fit in the box better. This is all very agonizing for me. Marie-Louise von Franz has come across Osiris often in dreams of mothers who have lost children. A woman who lost her young husband dreams, I arrive at a large gray mansion in something like a limousine. As I stand watch, people carry bodies and coffins into the house and set them on the ground floor of a large room. I help them carry jars of body parts in formaldehyde that we set on tables. I look closely at one jar and notice that it is a man's genitals. Now, I knew nothing of Osiris myth when I had my dream, and this woman knew nothing of that either. So this is the archetype that lives within our unconscious, the ancient traditions that we carry. And it's like an underground stream that we all carry these images, and it connects us in this very collective level of the unconscious. The death wedding. I've seen the wedding or union motif in one form or another in everyone's bereavement dreams. There's two kinds of wedding motifs. Both represent conjunctios, or the sacred marriage. For this deceased, it represents the union of the soul with the universe, the anima mundi. In many cultures, especially in Greece, funerals and weddings are viewed synonymously. A funeral is often referred to as a death wedding, and they sing the same songs at both. In some areas of Greece, a young unmarried person is buried dressed in wedding clothing, and parts of a young woman's dowry are buried with her in her coffin. Most Westerners are unaware of this, but they have these images in their dreams, which really shows how we're connected one to another. A mother who lost her 15-year-old daughter dreams, Michelle has been killed in a plane accident, and I have come to claim her belongings. I look in a scrapbook she was compiling and find an invitation to her future wedding. I think to myself, Michelle was organized. She already has her wedding invitation filed away here. 6 months later, the same mother dreams, we are organizing Michelle's funeral, but it also seems to be her wedding. There was a rehearsal party the night before, and I was confused about what I'd be attending the next day because of this. I'm at the church in an entrance hall watching all the people arrive. Most of them are dressed either in black or in white. Suddenly I realize that this is indeed Michelle's funeral and that I am saying goodbye forever to my dearest daughter. Then there's also the wedding of the bereaved. that suggest a union with bereavement or, in a later phase, a life transition into a new way of being. This is a dream had by a woman who lost her adult son. I am an attendant in a wedding. We are to wear black. That's the representation of the union of opposites, the bereaved with death. In another dream, I'm being married and wear my original wedding dress. I have been given some scruffy sandals to wear because on the way to the wedding, I must walk through a field of mud, which leads us now to the dark night of the soul, also known as the night sea journey. It's a natural part of the bereavement process and is often revealed in your dreams during the first year or two. The dark night is a representation of the deep sorrow and pain that's a part of the bereavement process. Darkness and suffering is the negredo, or blackness, of the alchemical process of transformation. It's the emotional chaos that one must experience prior to a new state of being. Von Franz states, enlightenment can come from that dark place. That is, if we direct the ray of consciousness upon it, if we warm it up by our conscious attention, then something white comes out, and that would be the moon, the enlightenment which comes from the unconscious. During this phase of emotional chaos, dreams often come forth in nightmarish images of death and dying, with attempts to survive a dark and life-threatening storm. Here's a dream. I'm lying with 18 dead men. The people who killed them think they've killed me too. I hold my breath to play dead so they won't detect me. Another dream. I'm fighting black sails in a dark night storm. The wind is very high. Lots of rain, and all I can do is battle the sails. A woman who lost her young husband dreams, my friend Cindy has died suddenly. At one point, I realized that Cindy knows the mystery of what happens after death, and it scares me. I picture her leaving her body and going up a tunnel, seeing light. Then I worry that maybe this really isn't possible, and she is simply gone forever. She was grieving again following this dream. She went again into a deep state of grief over it, fearing that she was going to lose her friend to death. But what it was really doing was forcing her to face the reality of death through the death of her friend in the dream. And it also brings up the death tunnel in this dream. Here's a recurring dream that I had following Michael's death. Michael's dead body is lying next to me in bed. I sense there is life on the other side of him, but can't see it. I wake up in deep agony. For the bereaved, the dark night is like living oneself in a state of death. It can be very, very intense and very powerful. And then there's deceased as spirit guide. In a study of more than 1,500 dreams following the loss of a loved one, Deirdre Barrett found that 23% of the dreams involved advice giving from the deceased. Some of the advice included helping the dreamer through grief, preparing for an upcoming loss, warnings about a life-threatening issue. Joel Martin, in his book Love Beyond Life, says, there is no greater, more binding love than that between parent and child, soulmates, husbands and wives, and through direct after-death communications, we know that death does not diminish or break this bond. These visits come any time, from shortly after their death to many years afterwards. I had a dream visitation from Michael 15 years later, just before the death of my mother. The mother who lost her son dreams. Andrew walks into the kitchen as if he never left. I'm excited to see him and give him a big hug. He says, "Yes, I've come back because there is just too much pain here." Another mother dreams following an evening of deep grief. John sits down on a sun porch couch next to me and takes my left hand in his and rubs the sore muscle at the heel of my thumb. It is so good to have him do this, and I jump up and feel young and limber. There is a deep pink wigalia bush blooming on the sun porch. I hear John say, "You must be contrite and willing, and then change can occur." And then there's transcendence. These are dreams that bring the sacred into our lives and guide us to ever-deepening dimensions of the psyche until we may find ourselves face-to-face with the reality of our souls. They come at any time in the bereavement process, even only days following the death. The morning after I had a very emotional conversation about Michael with his dear friend David, I awoke in ecstasy following a dream vision of fireworks and glittery handheld spirals twirling in the wind, all to the tune of the theme song from Terms of Endearment. Only 2 weeks after my son's death, I wrote in my journal, "I feel ecstatic, like I have accomplished something wonderful and I am in celebration of it." Robert Romanishin, in his book, The Soul in Grief, states, "Now, when I can allow myself to be embraced by these occasions, when I can let myself sink in reverie below the busyness of my life, when I can honor how the death of my wife opened my soul, I am also honoring her in sadness and in joy. In these moments, I marvel at the power of grief to open the soul to the hidden and forgotten radiance of beauty in the world." Now, my next series of slides, there's about a half a dozen slides here, are my visit to Oaxaca, Mexico during the Day of the Dead celebration. During the last week of October, the people of Mexico prepare for one of their most important annual celebrations, El Día de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead. Outdoor markets specific to this occasion appear with their campasuji, the marigold like flower of the season, hard long incense candles. That altar is actually the whole wall. They get very, very dramatic with their altars. These are ceramics and candies in the shape of skeletons and skulls, bread for the dead, and other items prepared for home altars and graves. Since ancient times, our southern neighbors have believed that early fall is when the boundary between life and death becomes permeable, allowing the souls of the living and the dead to commune. The celebrants believe that death transcends boundaries and expands upon and becomes intermingled with life on earth. Those who have died live in another realm, where they serve as a link between God and their loved ones who still live on the material plane. Children are taught early about death and how to respect and value the continued relationship they have with their ancestors. They play a key role in these ceremonies. As one villager said, to see all the lights, we know they have arrived. By shining your light upon your loss from a new perspective, not one of grief, something new within you happens. You may return to a conflict that was never resolved, become aware of the anger or guilt still there, and you may find a previously dead part of yourself come to life again. Okay. We can turn that off now, the projector. Toward the end of my book, I have a chapter called Your Bereavement Dream Sanctuary. In that chapter, I present rituals and things you can do to connect with your loved one after they're gone. I'd like to talk about that a little bit. We have bugs flying around, don't we? I talk about the home altar. How important it is to set up an altar. You see, you know, in El Dia de los Muertos, they'll put the whole wall, they'll make an altar. And it's just wonderful to have a little altar in your home where you can go and just sit and meditate in front of, to pray, to talk to your loved one. You can put candles on it, pictures, just mementos, anything that reminds you. It can be as wonderful, even more so than going to the grave, because it's right there and you can go anytime in your home, in the privacy of your home. And then there's prayer and meditation. You can pray to your loved one and go and meditate and speak to your loved one in meditation. And then you can also try to incubate a dream. Asking for a dream. You could ask for a dream, and then before you go to sleep, you sit and think about that you would like to have a dream. And make sure you put a notebook by your bed so when you do have your dream, when you wake up, you can write it down right away. So that's part of connecting with your loved one. And if a dream doesn't come, just keep trying. And if it still doesn't come, then it's really not meant to be. Perhaps another dream will come that'll show you that something else needs to happen instead of connecting with your loved one in this dream state. Maybe you need, there is a separation that needs to happen. Or maybe they're not able to have this connection with you. You know, it's just a real mystery. We really don't know. And then there's journaling and dream tending. Write your dreams down when you wake up before you jump up and go to the bathroom or whatever, which sometimes can be very difficult. But, you know, if you do that, you might forget your dream. You just grab your notebook. You have your notebook right there by your bed. And write the dream down before you do something else, or you might forget it. Some people are real wonderful, can remember their dreams very well. I'm not one of them. I need to write it down pretty quickly. Although I think through the years I've gotten better at that. I can at least go to the bathroom and come back and write my dream now. So that's pretty much it. For the rest of the evening, I think what we're going to do is have time for questions. How much time do we have? About a half hour?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Good. Okay. Yeah, okay. We'll just open it for questions. Yeah.
And it just hit me that that must have come out of that tradition you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
The closeness between the funereal and wedding experience.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah.
Did you also say something about the community at this time? Coming together of
the masculine and feminine?
Yeah.
I think the conjunctio is like a coming together of life and death.
In general, in this context.
Yeah. A male presence.
Yeah. It was a male presence. It wasn't just that it was your son, but the presence is in the first strings of this. So I'm wondering if this communication and the liminal state, do people report guardians or these guides, do they ever feel that these spiritual guides are the guardians?
Yeah, they do. It can be to have them come. You're talking about their deceased loved one come and be a guide for them.
Yes,
is probably what you're talking about.
Uh
huh. Yeah, actually, there's one dream series in my book where the mother struggles a lot. Her son committed suicide. He was in his 40s, and he was really there supporting her quite a bit and helping her through her grief. And he would often just sit back and be there as a presence for her to give her the strength that she needed to go through a difficult time. So they can come as like guardian angels. Uh-huh. To guide and support. It depends. You know, I think it really depends on how evolved the soul is. I think it has a whole lot to do with it. Yeah.
How evolved the soul of the dream?
Probably the one who died. But then also the one in grief too, you know, being able to be open to receiving. Because, you know, if you're not open to receiving, their presence can be nearby and you wouldn't be aware of it. So, yeah.
Uh-huh. It reminds me of, you know, the scene in Star Wars with Obi-Wan Kenobi, he gets killed, and
you know, didn't see that the guy, Luke Skywalker, he says he was going to trust the kids.
Sometimes it can be very powerful, and it can be frightening if you're not used to, you know, those kind of dreams. Actually, this Robert Romanishin, and I read a quote by him in his book. He lost his wife very suddenly, and she suddenly appeared very vivid in one of his first dreams early on. Usually they don't come within the first few months for some reason, which is interesting. You know, it's like they're not there for several months, and then suddenly they'll begin to have these dreams. So it was several months after, suddenly his wife was there, and it scared him so much. She went away. And then he was in grief because he scared her away. So. But then she came back later when he she came back in another tree.
Michael Spaulding, his grieving process similar to
you? Say that again.
Michael, your son's father. Was his grieving process similar to yours?
No, he didn't really have a whole lot of dreams. Actually, he had one dream when he actually went to work on bereavement, when he went into therapy. He did have a visitation dream by Michael. And I do talk about it in the book, yeah. But in a general, no, he doesn't dream. Pardon?
His son was killed, murdered.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no. No. Nothing. It was just deep, deep sadness. Actually, he was killed in an accident. You know, he wasn't actively killed. The boy didn't intend to kill him. It was, boys are always getting in fights. You know, not always, but that's a pretty common thing among boys in high school. Yes, he was. He actually served 9 months in a farm, a prison farm. But yeah. I hope that did that answer your question. Yeah. Yeah, it really takes attention and time to remember your dreams, and it has to be important. Although some people, dreams come and they don't have to really work so hard. They just seem to have more connection with this other dimension of reality. But like a dream incubation before you go to sleep is a good way to start remembering these dreams. And the way you do that is before you go to sleep, you tell yourself, I'm going to remember a dream. I'm going to be prepared to remember a dream. I want a dream. And you can even ask specifically what you want the dream for. And then you prepare it too. You really go through a ritual. You put the notebook by your bed so you're ready to write it as soon as you wake up. And have the thought in mind, I'm going to remember a dream. And then when you go to sleep, when you wake up the next morning, then before you jump up right away to go to the bathroom or whatever you have to do, lay there for a while. And just said, you know, gee, have I remembered something? Is there a dream there? And maybe you only have a little piece or something, and that's okay. Just write that down, even if it's a small image, because you're getting that habit going. And if you do that, you know, that you may not get a dream for a week if you do this every night. That's a possibility. But I'll bet you keep at it that, you know, within a week you're going to start having dreams to write down. It's a matter of letting your unconscious know you really want to take it. Want a dream, and you're going to take it seriously. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right. People are oftentimes afraid, you know, when they have someone, a dead loved one, visit them in a dream. Especially, you know, like 2 or 3 months have gone by and they still might be deep in grief, but they're trying to, you know, work through their grief. And then suddenly, you know, wow, they have this vivid dream and it's very frightening. And I think that's what happened with Robert Romanishin, you know, when his wife suddenly appeared there. And he says that she was very vivid, just right at the foot of his bed. And it just, it scared him and then it went away. But yeah, I think once you realize, though, that this is, that you can do that and it's part of the death process, that it's really a gift given to us, that it's really something that we could cultivate more. Oh, yeah. Can go to funeral homes and hand out my book. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Actually, I've worked with funeral home people, and many of them work very hard to work with the family. Some better than others, but it's pretty good. What some of them report is kind of interesting change as more people have their loved ones here, they find more people will take the remains of their loved ones home to keep them on my place or wherever. So that's happening way more often. But when it's people who are not so close to them, they often just leave them through them home. Never pick them up. And there's no place to take them.
Oh, wow.
So it's very, very differentiated things. What's not happening is like in public service. Yeah, funerals. There's less funerals overall. Or memorial services there?
That's
what I would do. Yeah. Whether the body's there or not, whatever kind of service is held after the rest of the house, and someone very close, the ashes are often kept right in the living room and the home, kind of almost like you have to dance something. But if it's not someone close, they're not going to pick them up.
So then what do they do with these ashes then?
After certain amount of time, the home
That's real sad. Wow.
Funeral homes are very sharp.
It's very sad.
So they pack, usually have places where the ashes are put. But that's after a certain time, like a couple of years.
You know, our culture really has a difficult time with death, too. You know, we're just, we hurry, let's get it over with, let's clean it up, and let's go back to work. And boy, that really makes it very difficult in the grief process, because you know it takes several years of real transition, and we need to be educated that it's okay. We don't have to go to work and be on top of the world again. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I feel like I lost that, and I'm quite sure. You know, I was just thinking right now, so I might go up to Sunrise and spend the night there alone. But again, it's not the
garden spot. Yeah. Have you thought about setting up an altar in your home?
Well, yeah, I used to have a little thing right there. I don't know if I want it at home, but I can be in my own home.
Maybe in your backyard, even, you know, that's. There was one of the people in my book. I don't know if I wrote about it in that chapter, but she actually planted an area, a garden in her yard. Planted some trees and they actually did bury the ashes there. That was the place. It was, they can go and visit at any time. You know, just go and sit in this part of the yard.
I buried a cat, my first cat I loved when I was 12. I have gone back to the
spot. Yeah.
From the same way that I think about it, it's 17 places in the world. That's where it was.
Yeah.
Were you just
And there's something there, I know there's something here. Why the ashes, for example, didn't any of them not have any flowers.
You know, I find interesting animal in Mexico. So one of the things that I learned from this country that was what a contrast with the issue of, you know, death and dying was that when several relatives die, usually traditionally the person dies and the property is brought to the house. And he's kept in the house with candles for 24 hours. And just all the family members come and sit for hours and hours and cry and so on. But it's a time, at that time, it's a time of sadness, it's a time of sorrow, grief, it's the loss. Mm-hmm. Intense, I mean, as it can be. And people come and go, and just goes for 24 hours. Then when I came here, I went to the first funeral, there was a celebration. It's like, oh my God, what's going on here? Where's the sadness? You know, this guy, someone died. And they're talking about the dog and this. It just seems so trivial. I was pretty shocked. When the issue of celebration about the person's life kind of comes later in time, after the person dies, here my sense was like too soon, too quickly. Hygienic. They just clean them up, get them up, and we're happy. Life was wonderful. And I feel like, you know, it is bad. It's really sad, the person died. So anyway, I just was listening to what you were saying about the issue of death and how the whole thing is digested, so to speak. And it's just very different.
Yeah, and we're gonna suffer from that too. I think that people they have this pain, they have this deep sorrow, and they have no place to go to for it to be acknowledged, for them to talk about it. And if they do feel sorrowful, they feel something's wrong with them, and it's real unfortunate for us.
A distant family member that died of AIDS here in Seattle. And once again, you know, when someone tries to cry, it's like the night they feel of the cry. No, we'll be fine. He loved life. He was wonderful. Yeah. And in Mexico, you know, you will say the person died. Oh my God, how terrible. How sad. Sure. Oh my God. And just cry more. So it was like quite a contradiction when you go through one step versus the other. So.
We have a lot to learn. Maybe we'll come back.
Well, I don't know if it's right or wrong. It's just there.
It's a disconnect. It's really a disconnect from a very spiritual part of ourselves. Because I think through the connection with our deceased loved ones, we really connect with this other dimension, or the soul dimension of reality.
Isn't accepting the death of someone else in part accepting your own?
I would.
So you mourn for both you and them at the same time.
Yeah. Well, the death that you have is the loss. So the loss is like a death. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like when your parents die, that loss, you become well aware of your next in mind.
There's not a buffer generation ahead of you waiting to go, you know. It's your turn next. Yeah, I think that's...
Well, you start preparing then, don't you? Thinking about it more. And yeah. Through the grief? Oh, definitely. Actually, that comes through in the dreams too, in the dark night of the soul. I don't know if I had read that dream about the woman, maybe I didn't put it in, whose son had died, had actually been bound up and wrapped with the dead. And she was going through a very, very deep grief during that period, really feeling like death herself. That's the dark night of the soul. And they need to go through that period. That's a period. There's no escaping it. No, you have to go there. Yeah. If you don't, then later on in life you're going to be suffering.